Good evening. It's Wednesday night, and it's 7 o'clock, and we're working our way through Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. Tonight, we're on Chapter 10. we're just doing what I call slow reading. We're taking our time to read the document at a pace that we all can get a sense of. So, in order to achieve that as a group, it's important that the groups speak up. So the name of the chapter is Data Retrieval in the Higher Dimensions. As if you're listening to the recording of this later, this part about speaking up doesn't apply to you, but you're welcome to speak up in any event. But you can go and post on the website, which is wingsofchaos.com, wingsofchaos.com, and you can see the links to then the book Life in the Labyrinth, Chapter 10. And there's it's a meaty chapter, and there's two different levels of understanding of this chapter, and we'll approach both of those a little bit this evening, Ivan. So do you want to get us started then?
Okay, for the data retrieval in the higher dimensions, the summary statement. Shamanism was first developed thousands of years ago to satisfy macro-dimensional needs, something rejected because it is not focused on common primate goals, subject only to higher laws beyond the reach or ken of the human world.
So really, we understand this. I think there's not a lot of, we understand that work in the higher dimensions, work in the inner, in any way, winds up eventually being rejected, in a sense, by the populace. It is because it always comes down to what's the pragmatic value here? You know, how does this really help me? And really what we're talking about in a case like that is what helps my human biological machine do what it does better. And as we've discussed in the entire book that we studied, the HBM, Human Biological Machine as a Transformational Apparatus, also by E.J. Gold, there are two parts to us. We are an electrical being that is split. We are an electrical body called the HBM, Human Biological Machine, and we're also an essential self that expresses itself through presence and attention. And it's bringing those two into a particular type of harmony that is our possibility and our work here. The shaman, then, is someone who, as is indicated here, does something to satisfy macro-dimensional needs. Well, macro-dimensional needs do not have to do with human needs.
Right.
Therefore, eventually, that posture is shunned because it disrupts the very foundation of it, which is called simple survival. People interpret that simple survival in many, many different ways. We are looking into the shadows to see what it is that is important to us. And so we're going to explore the history of shamanism, and we're going to touch on two very important points that are given us here in the chapter. Before we get started on that, though, I want to point out that on Chapter 9, which is what we covered last week, the art and science of invocation, Harry posted a very interesting question on that, and I gave a very, very cursory answer to it. His question had to do with, and Ivan, do you remember?
I believe it was the mood. I thought it was a very interesting question because Harry was asking for what is the difference in the mood between evocation.
Is Pianjoan.
Chamber or a situation where there's evocation going on.
Okay.
And invocation.
Okay, so it's a huge topic, and I didn't answer it well when I did answer it, and I'm not sure that there's time to answer it now, but I wanted to remember that question.
Yeah, I think it would be great if everybody in this group thought about that and posted some experiential example or evidence for Harry, like what is my sense of the mood of evocation and the mood of invocation?
It was a great question.
From experience.
Great question. So I'll go back later and post more on that. But at the moment, we're going to work our way through chapter 10 here. So let's just get started really quickly. And we're going to move through this in a certain way rapidly. That we may understand the origin of shamanism, we must turn to the ancient world. It was the first form of religion, yet it was not looked at as a religion. The word religion didn't even exist yet. Shamanism today is automatically associated with religion and cultism, because the human primates can't imagine any use for these ideas, and we understand that. The appearance of the word religion forms a line of demarcation between unembellished macro-dimensional voyaging and ritualized pseudo-spiritual hysteria. So what happens is that in the past, when it was simpler, a different kind of culture, people were less, they were less blocked in a certain way. And they knew that the macro dimensions were a real thing. Now our society has allowed us to be totally closed to that. We can occlude that and just go about with what I call the cult of busyness. I'm sure everybody on the line here is going to say, oh, I'm really busy. No, I can't do that tomorrow. Everybody, whether they work, don't work, whether they have a high-powered job or not, everybody's absolutely fully busy. It's this cult of busyness, this addiction to being busy to get us away from the touching of this macro dimension. Shamanism probably appeared at about the same time as the first dim glimmer of intelligence dawned upon the primates who were to eventually walk erect. The very first shaman happened by chance to make their discoveries regarding beings and conditions of higher dimensions through their service to the chief of the tribe. Let's just unpack that a little bit. So, something was going on. The tribal collective was important, and somebody was able to be of unique service to the chief and to give a particular kind of direction. And so then these verse shamans, they acted as something like the modern-day intelligence operatives, conveying themselves and their macro-dimensional information intact to the dimensional scales, utilizing the Prometheus effect on their village-oriented vision quest. What does that mean to you? What does that mean? I mean, tell me what that, you explain it to me. Anybody? Mm-hmm. Ivan. Ivan's here.
Well, I know that Prometheus was inspired from in defiance of
Zeus.
Yeah, the creator god or gods. Prometheus gave technology, gave fire and the means of improving civilization and so on to humans. And he was summarily punished for doing that. Yeah.
There was one of the great plays of antiquity was Prometheus Bound, written by Aeschylus. And in this play, which was, by the way, interesting in that this Greek tragedian was one of the first to actually bring other actors into the structure of a play. We had conversation to understand the concept. Prometheus is there bound, on this rock.
Yeah.
He's bound on the rock. and there's no way of him getting out. And he's complaining. He says, here I am bound, a god bound by the gods. So what did it mean that he went and took fire and brought it to man? And why is it in this paragraph? Do we have any answers on the chat log? Or
what do we have, Molly?
Well, here's
what Pastor said. Somebody says he's addicted to busy. I mean, you're that part.
So
how about the Prometheus effect?
So what does it mean, or what might it mean, the Prometheus effect? Dig a little deeper here. This isn't just a passive event here called, I'm online now. What does it mean? It's all sitting there. Prometheus brought fire and handed it to humans, and there was a whole category of arts that he handed to. But he disrupted some balance, and he was punished for that.
Stealing involved, wasn't it? I mean, it was a matter of theft from the higher.
Ah.
In this case, you know, it was something coming from the higher that was, called proprietary. It belonged in a higher dimension. Or
clearly, was it
resembled a higher dimension?
These ancient myths, expounded by, actually, apparently, Aeschylus had three plays about this, and I think only one survived, but. Bottom line is, it was really critical, this conversation. Prometheus was godlike. He was one of the original Titans, so he was a powerful god. So he brought fire from that dimension to the humans. Certainly it doesn't just mean the combustion of fuel, heat, and oxygen that happens arbitrarily in nature anyway. So the myth must be talking about something else. It must be talking about something to do with data retrieval in the higher dimension. This is an important myth. It is powerful in our all mythology, by the way. You see it. So part of what we're talking about is a forbidden knowledge. And that which is forbidden is, if you bring celestial information and you place it at the feet of the human, you're at great risk. And why are we at great risk at that time? What's at great risk? What's at great risk is the misinterpretation of that data. It'll be shanghaied by the human biological machine for its use.
Well, it's very strong, and in AJ's opening here, I was struck in rereading it, I was struck by how strong the link is that he portrays between the survival, the survival of the tribe, the survival of the community. You know, that shaman is being commissioned to go out there and get this information and bring it back. So, and he says, somewhere in there, I don't know if we hit that passage, where he says, well, along the way, he stops for a little macro-dimensional learning and does a few other errands and so on. In other words, the shaman has his own voyaging to do, but he's commissioned to do it for survival of the community, to do a specific thing. So yeah, what have you got over there?
Go ahead. Prometheus gave us fire, a gift
of grace.
Grace. Yanja. Say it again, that Jim Hodgkins is saying that.
Like fire transforms?
Human transformation.
So that it could bring about human transformation. Yeah, this is beginning to sound a little more like the fire. In Plato, like some hundreds of years later, you have this allegory of the cave, and you've got a fire in there, which is casting shadows on the wall, which is the the shadow knowledge, you know, the illusory knowledge, and then outside the cave is the real light, which is the sun. And all this has to do with, you know, with Plato. He's talking about it's an allegory of actually comprehension and truth and justice and so on.
And in
that
a sense,
the real understanding or the real, so the source of value, the source of any kind of value at all, is way outside the cave somewhere.
Go ahead.
Prometheus gave man the divine spark, the inner fragment of light. Yeah, it seems like what was humanity lacking?
Why was he punished?
Ah, yeah, there we go. Ah, okay. Simon says he brought to humans knowledge that didn't belong to the humans. Is that right? Yeah, it's something from another dimension.
And what?
The ability to become divine and godlike. That's beginning to sound like the Greeks.
Good. So that which burns the lower vibrations. So in a certain way, the Prometheus effect, and my meaning that I take from this chapter, is that Prometheus brought the divine down and presented the divine to the undeveloped humans.
Mm-hmm.
And the risk of doing that was great. And the risk of doing that was great because the humans will then take that and use it for their own gain. They will
indeed
convert it, and that, and maybe he should have been so punished. It's the same as the serpent in the garden story, Sinhog is telling us.
Yeah, I was pointing out earlier to David that there's, you know, with this kind of Joseph Campbell formulation, this repeated attempts, let's say, to create humanity that fail, you know, and the failure of humanity to achieve something greater and something higher is fairly universal. I mean, there's the Popol Vuh in South America. There, in all kinds of world mythologies, there is this element of an attempt to create appropriate beings, or beings who respond appropriately to their creator.
This,
you know, maybe a slightly different matter, but it's, you know, in thinking about, it's interesting that this is, we're in Western civilization, we look at Greek mythology, but it seems to me that the closest examples that we would have for this type of consciousness, let's say, which is tribal, communitarian, you know, not separated consciousness, it's certainly got to be the Native American. Because you see, just even in a movie like Little Big Man, you see this spirituality. In the Native American tribes, you can hardly say that there's a religion.
It's absolutely.
There's just a life in nature, and there's a life with in communion or in some kind of dialogue with the invisible world.
And there's a respect from the most common of the tribe members, there's a respect upward of that world.
Yeah.
There's a respect of it, and that's the respect that I think is the problem here.
Hey,
go ahead.
Hey, Dave, I was just going to throw in a couple of pennies myself.
Good.
The way I understand this is that all of us have within us the potentiality of a Jacob's ladder, which allows us to ascend from the multiplicity and diversity of a fragmented creation, which is what our HBM experience is. But we can climb this Jacob's ladder up to the top, where we experience the unity of everything existing, which is our essential self. And the Prometheus effect asks the question, to what degree are we successful in ascending that ladder to bring down an awareness of how our essential self can be integrated within the HBM. That's what the shamans seem to be able to do naturally. But for myself, I've got here in front of me Genesis chapter 11 regarding building of the Tower of Babel, and I'd like to just read for a moment, because it basically expresses the same idea. Now, the whole earth used the same language and the same words. So that's us at our moment of conception. We experience everything all at once. It came about as they journeyed each, so that they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used brick for stone, and they used tar for mortar. And they said, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. So there, and the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they all have the same language, and this is what they began to do, and now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. Let us go down and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of the whole earth, and that stopped the building of the city. And therefore the name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them over the face. So this basically talks about how our essential self, which speaks a single language, gets fragmented and fractured and becomes the totality of the human biological machine, and prevents us from climbing the ladder of Jacob again, unless we figure out, well, how to get those two hands coordinated with one another again.
Well, this is a great commentary and perfect timing, because one thing you said, Silverdale, was that when you climb Jacob's ladder and you get to the top, you can see the unity of all things. Well, what is the tool that you use to do that scene when you're at that top of that ladder? That is the essential self. It is not the human biological machine that you force up there and then it just gets smarter. It's a different part of us altogether. It's the different electrical body called the essential self. That's what's there. That's what's available to see in that space. If you try to take the human biological machine into that space, you will fall to the fate of those who are attempting to build the Tower of Babel. They were building it from the ground up as humans, and they forgot that they need to become godlike in order to even see the gift that was before them. Very interesting. What tool do you use? And we forget this. And we think, oh, I'm pretty darn smart. I'll be able to figure it out. That's not the point.
You know, and really the value of EJ's insight into the fact that the essential self is another electrical field within the human biological machine helps us understand that the essential self, the way I experience it, is a vibratory sensation of white light in infinite extension, which is nothing more than a particle of divinity spread through the whole of the creation. And that's a tough mountain to climb like Sisyphus. Invariably, the stone keeps getting away from us.
And we come back and we start again. And gradually, we get stronger. And we that we're talking about here is that which is able to climb. That is the essential self. It's the confusion of trying to be a smarter human biological machine versus a fundamental shape-shifting. And Ivan, that's where we get into the part that we're going to move on here, but that's the critical point, and we're going to see the Jacob's Ladder terminology in a few pages here. Because of this, and then there's a long discussion about how, you know, the shaman attempted to perfect this and was working to understand what was going on. And, of course, the shaman is rejected by regular society. This is the fundament, this is the fate of the human biological machine versus the essential self. But if we sense the fact that we have two different characteristics that we're bringing forward, then we have really something unique. This is some of the most unique information that has been presented by E.J. Gold and his material in the human biological machine and now life in the labyrinth. Really fundamentally different than in anything out there that I've read. Jumping ahead, not surprisingly, the tribe would remain studiedly oblivious to the means by which the shaman accomplished his higher dimensional missions. They don't want to know about it. They didn't know, they don't want to know. Superstition dictated their occlusion. We have a chance here as fellow voyagers to accept the responsibility of being that voyager and accepting, dropping that occlusion and saying, when I am taking a step up Jacob's ladder, I am in that space. It's fundamentally different. It's not, how can I be a better human biological machine? We're not after that. That's not our... The shaman has a tendency to subject themselves to severe stress. And that's part of the tool that is used. The shaman uses the tool to begin the voyaging process. Stress does not... It means different things for different people. Among early human beings, the shaman was a tribal asset, an egg, metaphorically speaking, to be nurtured and protected. Typically, he was provided with a warm, dry cave. In other words, the tribe took care of the shaman because they knew that every once in a while they were going to need it. They don't quite want to know what he did, and they certainly don't want to do it because they don't want to get that weird, because it was weird. Weird from what context? Context of the HBM, right? Okay. What Ivan's looking for is about the... Okay. Let me just continue, and then you can stop us when you get there, okay? And now he talks about that the shamanism, like he says, the Sumerians were surprisingly competent shamans. This is the city, this is Ur, Sumer, Elam, the whole region there. This Ur, of course, is where Abraham emerged from. So all of these, he emerged from the tribes where shamanism was replete in the civilization, was more part of it. His unique gift, of course, was formulating the concept of the one God.
EJ also always, he repeats in various places that this idea that the Sumerian brotherhood, you know, the Sumerian priesthood or shaman compact was, to, you know, predates the Egyptian and then inspired the Egyptian priesthood and the Egyptian mysteries.
So what's happening here is that the group collective is gathering knowledge and data. We can do the same thing. Particularly if you have the opportunity to meet and work with another, then you're combining data points. I'm not done with the Prometheus fire, by the way.
Yeah,
I'm going
right.
to come back to that.
Yeah, that's a good
We're
one.
Going to end with that. But the Sumerians were competent shamans. For all of their cultural formalization, and then he goes on to say that Shaw woman, because the priestesses were quite involved at that time. The profound shamanistic knowledge possessed by the Sumerians and Babylonians later formed the main body of classical Sufism. And this is a lot of what EJ has based his work on, is, you know, the Sufic formulation. And, you know, we're not going to go into that in detail, but that's a profound... offering, I would say, into shamanistic. Some Sufi groups have managed to retain their freedom from suffocation of Islam, which it was now it's identified with. However, there was a hotbed of shamanistic activity, primarily in the area of Raimundo Lull's Mallorca. That's that, you know, we spoke about Ramon Lull and his the beloved, the lover and the beloved, and his great classical Christian mystic work that we've talked about over the years. And he says that's the home of Western shamanic alchemy. As shamanism developed from the formal science into a broad intuitive art, the inevitable separation into two main branches become more and more accentuated. And there was, the tribal shamanism, Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Mayans, fabulously innovative and elaborate techniques of shape-shifting. Are you with me there, Evan?
I see you.
Through some of the most extravagantly exotic macro-dimensional morphology anyone can ever encounter along the totemic ladder. Does this get us to where you wanted to?
Yeah, perhaps. Well, I mean, you mentioned that this is this dichotomy that he's talking about is going from the, how to win the next battle next week with a little prescience or something like that of the shaman helping out the chief, and then this serve the secret purposes of work among the beings of the macro dimensions.
Okay,
so again, it's like the higher, serving the higher is the more esoteric function of the shaman.
So the shaman, as they voyaged into the macro dimension, they realized that those beings had a purpose too, that there were macro dimensional beings, and that there was something there about that.
Well, I think it's curious. There's a curious aspect of this. I mean, it suggests it's sort of, I don't know if EJ refers to this directly, but it makes the shaman a kind of a double agent. It's like the shaman's coming back to the chief and saying, sure, this is the way, if we make these offerings, and how about if we roll some rocks around and we'll build this altar over here and so on, and then you're bound to win this battle next week and so on. But there's, in actuality, the shaman has done all of this voyaging and is coming back, is dealing with something unrevealed, which is a completely different set of processes and principles.
Fundamentally
different. With a macro-dimensional reality, requirements.
So I'm on the new version here. I'm going to jump ahead a few pages to page 110, and the paragraph is, the early experimenters discovered something important about assuming the shapes of animals. Is this
page 97?
Yeah, I have it 97 in this edition.
This, I think, is what you were getting at, Arthur.
Maybe.
The early experimenters discovered something important about assuming the shapes of animals, meaning their characteristics and attributes, which later formed the basis for the dynastic and proto-dynastic Egyptian shamanism. So you wanted to say a little something about that.
The attributes of certain animals help them to extend their morphology, this is the shamans, far beyond the human primate form. We should understand that the idea is not to assume the actual shapes of these animals, which is as in Hollywood movies recently, but that animal shapes could be used to suggest how the human morphology might be extended. I thought this is a really striking idea here, a striking formulation. It has to do with the use of presence and attention. It's like saying, that those Egyptian gods with the head of the jackal and the head of the ibis and the cow and so on, it's not suggesting either dressing up, as a part human, part animal being, or acting, let's say, or interacting with people as a wolf or a jackal or something like that. But it has to do with what he's talking about here, which is that some features of those animals, attributes of the animal's awareness of the animal's behavior,
the characteristics
are keys or part of the method
yes.
of expanding attention. expanding awareness, what it calls morphology, you know, expanding the morphology into additional far-flung chambers.
Let me ask you a question then, Ivan, if that's true.
Yeah.
So let's say that I'm stuck in a chamber and there's a very difficult situation. I'm having a tremendous struggle in that chamber of some sort, okay? But I'm able to recall and remember the idea of presence and attention. So is that not an indication that I have available to me at that moment the possibility of this being of shape shifting into a form that can deal with that particular?
That would be one of the processes. One of the
but
techniques.
How do I do that?
Well, I thought you were on the verge of saying it's like there's something that you can't overcome or you can't solve, and then you invoke, let's say, having experienced or practiced these processes, or let's say had an apprenticeship of shapeshifting. You know, you draw upon for that moment the attributes of a tiger, or the attributes of a cheetah, or the attributes of a
how about
orangutan.
What if you're being crushed by a great bear and just And if you fight the bear head on, or you bring it to yourself, you'll be defeated. But if you can find presence and attention, maybe you can shape shift into the shape of an ermine,
or a bird,
or something
bird
that is
flies away
that is facile.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the part of the concept at this point, and these are real things. About real events that people have. So learning how to shapeshift doesn't mean, oh, I'm a crow, can you see my wings?
Right.
It means, as a crow, you hop and you complain and
well,
you fly.
Well, it's a very strong, I think there's a really, this little passage is not, it's very specific, but it's not detailed, it's not explicit, but to me, this is like an invitation. It's a very strong suggestion that that this is a way to experiment with awareness, with presence.
And what it is an invitation at learning how to be a shapeshifter.
Yeah.
Moving between worlds that's appropriate to that world. If you say, oh, I can be just as strong as a bear, well, maybe you can, but maybe you have to develop other tools then, or maybe you're more naturally a particular just like this a mink that can float,
or an otter
that can float through the space. So the idea of shapeshifting then takes on a really different concept here, and so these guys, they were out there experimenting with this and finding this data, and now we come to why the chapter. Mm-hmm. An instructional text like the Papyrus of Ani recommended specific totemic form expressions for each macrodimensional chamber represented as the afterlife, the practicing shaman. So what we have here is that now some people have come back and they said, okay, here's how I saw it. And I guarantee you, this isn't one guy that just kind of wrote down and he goes, oh yeah, I'm the guy. This was probably developed over 1,000 years or a few hundred years of people notating what they thought and then their peers focusing on it and adjusting it until they go, of course that's right. And then it's that's right. So how does that then affect us? They were familiar with animals in ways that we are not and used them to draw upon the characteristics of higher dimensional beings. Animal forms were used as a notation system to guide voyagers into the recognitions of chambers. Like sometimes you need to be like a snake moving to a chamber. It's the only way to get through it. The only way to get through it. Sometimes you have to stalk. But those are the romantic people. I'm a stalker. I'm like a jaguar, mm-hmm. Or I'm the big condor. Maybe not. Maybe what's needed in that space is the sparrow. And then, of course, this corresponds roughly to the bird-like attributes of the characters in Attar's Conference of the Birds, where we spoke about in Joy of Sacrifice.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Typicalities.
And there are typicalities there of each bird had a particular, and they were talking about finding, once again, this teamwork,
mm-hmm.
which we touched on last week. Shape-shifting is a means by which the shaman is able to voyage up and down the full spectrum of dimensional scales without totally disastrous consequences. And does this make sense to you, Silverdale, in regard to Jacob's ladder?
Yes, it does. It's just like climbing a musical scale, isn't it? It's
nicely put.
There are tones, but we are eventually able to learn to distinguish between tones or different dimensions or different rungs on the ladder. A couple of weeks ago, I used that illustration of an elevator. You know, can we install an elevator with buttons 1 to 100 for 100 floors, and whichever button you push, the doors open, and it's a different view, both out into the interior of the building and out the windows to the larger horizon.
So remember this attribute of shape shifting then, and what it kind of means. And what we're talking about, the challenge to each one of us here, is this is not something, I read about this, or that's what they do in the Hopi tribes do that. I'm talking about people that live in Riverside, California, in suburban households and have dogs. That's what it's referring to, too. Although voyaging shaman couldn't actually be permanently destroyed, which is good and bad, I guess, their information and knowledge could become distorted and obliterated, and they could be temporarily destroyed, their work effort at that time. And this is the whole pearls before swine issue that is very important. And we have to be careful, which puts more work on your shamanic work, the shamanic work that you're doing, at whatever level you're doing it. Rituals were enacted to draw down a higher entity to the totem or column, which became a lightning rod for the descending form. Now, we're going to go into this just for few minutes. The shaman would then leave the totem, communicate the macro-dimensional data, note that well, and through him or her, the macro-dimensional inhabitant would demonstrate its job in the real world. What does that mean? The macro-dimensional inhabitant.
It's a very matter-of-fact statement, but that's really powerful stuff.
Do we know what this means? Are there people stating the answer to my question on the log right now, Jenna?
No
answers, but it says right here, it's right here in black and white, the macro-dimensional inhabitant would just demonstrate its job in the real world.
Well,
the words are right there.
This is like saying that as a specialist in this tribe, I perform the dance or the ritual that manifests Raven, that it manifests Coyote, and my audience sees what Raven or Coyote does.
It's also saying that there may be macro-dimensional beings. This, in fact, is stating that there are macro-dimensional beings, and that those macro-dimensional beings have, it says, demonstrate its job in the real world. Initiates could ask questions of that entity, but this required exact knowledge and an understanding of macro-dimensional language. They had to know how to extract reliable information without offending it. Note well, macro-dimensional entities tend to be very short-tempered during their hopefully brief encounters with lower species. I'm going to make 2 points here. One is, I've talked at length over several of the classes we've had about the Seamorg experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And Ivan, I think, has posted somewhere the totem about that. That's where the group was able to work cooperatively to allow this entity to form that evening. Now, what I can say is that there was information and knowledge about. I don't know what it is, and I'm not interpreting it with my brain.
Right.
There was knowledge there. The room was filled with it.
Yeah, because it was associated with that macro-dimensional inhabitant.
Right.
Let me just, as a footnote, just say, for Piangio, whatever is described in that account, Kelly's first-person account of the Simorgh experiment, that is definitely a mood of invocation.
Invocation.
Mood that's described there was a highly invocational mood.
In a sense, the invocational mood was dictated by that higher macrodimensional being, whereas when we evoke, we're yearning to go up. And that might be a little bit of a hint of it. I don't really know. The second point I want to make is I want to remind us of Dante. And good old Dante, when he was finished with Purgatorio and Virgil had to go away and Beatrice came to lead him into Paradiso.
It's the new ally, our guide. Yeah.
His guide then was Beatrice because Virgil couldn't go there. And when he entered into Paradiso, the angelic being saying, you know what? There's no way you can understand what we're talking about. There's just no way, because you're not built like that.
Angel language.
And the angel said, but we will diminish ourselves into the form that you could understand. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were ill-tempered at that moment.
Were they?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. We're going to do this for you, but we're going to regret it.
Yeah. By divination, the shaman would try to get an indication as to which entity was angry with the tribe or which entity turned its back on the tribe. Then he would set out to visit that entity in his own dimension, its own chamber. In doing so, he would select a partner or several partners who, as a whole, acting and arousing a subjective state with him in concert, thus represented the entity. And that's a very small part of what we're doing here. We're allowing something to come forth, and that's part of what our work is. I'm kind of jumping ahead, and I'm not really wanting to go through the rest of this paragraph in detail, because I want to come back to this idea of the Promethean fire and speak on that for a bit and get people's insights into that. So if we can voyage and we move away, as Silverdale was saying, a couple of rungs up the ladder, are we not then emissaries of that world, and can we not bring something back to our fellow voyagers? And how do we do that? Are we doing that? I know some people here work as healers, and I know that in order to do that even remotely decently, you have to enter these spaces. And it's that information then you're bringing back that to a willing recipient, I hope. So as voyagers, we're kind of stuck with the burden of trying to bring some of this data back. There's a principle, I don't remember where I read it, but on this golden ladder, this ladder of Jacob, you can't reach down too many rungs below you. You can't do it. So if there's somebody that's way up on the ladder that's working and bringing data down, they can't directly connect with people at just the beginning of the ladder. But we're beginners. We're a little advanced beginners. So maybe we can give the true beginner some information. So what do you think about that?
Sounds like something worth doing.
Any comments about...
Sounds like a beginning of work.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get in. So is that a form of work that is important for you? Do you see that as part of your burden, in a sense, as young, budding shaman?
I have a comment.
Yes.
This is Susan.
Yes, it is.
It seems to me that, like, the shape-shifting that we do all the time, say if you're in an interaction with somebody and maybe it's going to be a fight, you decide, are you going to come at it and be a bear? Are you going to come at it and be meek? And then whatever you shift into brings a flavor back from, say, whatever dimension that you have chosen.
Yes.
So we're shape-shifting. Well, so we're shape-shifting all the time.
If you are in the human dimension and you're just good at avoiding stuff, that's one form of it. But we are in the real, we are in the human world. So we're attacked, hit all the time. We have the special tool of maybe stepping into a little bit of the macro dimension at that time and bringing something different to that potential battle. And so we can become surprisingly unique and different rather than holding on to the linearity of, oh, this is the way that you fight a battle. So mm-hmm. I'm saying, don't just be a better human, but actually perform what Susan is suggesting to us here. Actually be a shapeshifter at all times. Because if that argument is going on, you can look at it one of two ways. You can go, oh gosh, that person's attacking me. Or you can look at it, you can just see, I observe that that's occurring. Now, as I observe that that's occurring, what's a move I can make here? I can fight it head on and fall into the fight. That's the simple path that I've taken often, the reactive path.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can dance into a different place altogether. And a lot of that dance is going to be, the initial part of it is going to be a form of surrender. And in that form of surrender, Susan, I think we can bring a tool that isn't even in the, not even there, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's risk. You're talking about taking the supreme risk also. It's like you're throwing your, what Silverdale calls historical personality to the wind. I mean,
that's correct.
You invoke whatever. You invoke something higher, and you don't necessarily know what that's going to be, let's say. If you decide to not be your ordinary self, let's say, if you start with that decision,
nice item.
That I'm gonna
very.
I always react in such a way. You know, these people, this person makes me mad. This situation always gets me this way. Then, if you can have that moment of freedom, you know, to step back from it and say, then you don't necessarily know what's going to fill that vacuum. But it's like you have to create the space first.
So, what do you mean by a moment of freedom? Freedom from what? What are you talking about?
Freedom from mechanicality, freedom from fixity, from what you call it. Yeah.
So if you always fight with your coworker, or you always fight with the teller at the bank or the dry cleaning person, it's like, what if you went in there and this fight began and suddenly you did something weird? You put in the effort to invoke attention and presence. And you sidestepped it. You were there in full attention, but you sidestepped the natural form of linearity, and you became something different. At that moment, you have an opportunity to free yourself and that person.
Yeah, and that's a shaman move. Yeah. That's a shaman move.
I recall being, I was at this particular store, and I'm checking out, and it's, you know, just hugely busy. And the teller was in some kind of mood going on. So when I came up to the teller, I just, rather than react to the mood and say, why isn't this person treating me better? I just kind of exhibited a particular kind of simplicity and joy. By the time my little transaction was over, their mood had shifted fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
We can do that because we do have that little extra. Anything?
Yeah, we're got a few minutes left.
Yeah, but Molly's about to say something. Who said that? Jim is saying.
If we work for our own gain and not the good of all, then what's the rest of it?
Trapped in our own ego.
Yeah, we'd be trapped in our own.
Of course.
Repetitions.
Was all she needed to do. She was attacked in a dream, and she said, oh, I can invoke attention and prayer. So in that space, when she was in attention and presence, she was able to see it in an objective light rather than in a reactive light. She was able to see it with broader eyes. And then she saw with crystal clarity before she vibrated out of the space. So part of the skill of the shaman is being able to stay in that sense of attention and presence and shape-shift into whatever form allows us to be there with greater activity for the good of all beings everywhere, and not just our particular ego at this particular time.
There's also an indication there that in regard to these techniques, there may be something that we can learn from our dream selves, from our dreaming selves, in regard to morphology, this shape changing. A lot easier. More easily done in dreams.
So we're getting to the end of it, but all of these are techniques and data that we're putting once again on our belt, our work belt. It's another tool. This idea of shape shifting and the responsibility, in a sense, of bringing this data back from the macro dimensionals so that we can. It's data retrieval, and we can then share that data with our voyagers, and that's something we can do. So, you know, Ivan, do you want to go ahead and?
Are we toward the end of the
yeah, I'm going to just quickly read some of the last few paragraphs. The life of a school is always circumscribed. Schools are not meant to exist indefinitely because they fulfill specific purposes. Schools exist when there is a need for work. This reflects the greater relation to the work of the creation. The work is not something stable and repetitive. It changes constantly, has many forms. Though the availability of the work may fluctuate and its form may change radically, the nature of the work never changes. Though many neophyte shamans may fall into the trap of convention, devoting their entire work lives to the dead forms of the past. When a school has died before the completion of a task, another school appears to finish the business of the first.
There's a lot in that, the dead forms thing. I was just looking back to the previous chapter in regard to the kind of aesthetic of invocation, you know, where
Yeah.
Ishii talks about, you know, these various wonderful painters that I like a lot, Turner and Monet and Jules Verne, the great science fiction writer, but he characterized them as being sort of this conventional
Yeah.
type of imagination, whereas his short list is Peter Sellers, Einstein, Tesla, Fritz Lang, and Gurdjieff, indication of whose intent, intuitional invocation.
And there have been many...
Drawing inspiration down from the macro dimensions.
And there have been many geniuses, you know, like Teresa of Avila is one that I count in that sense of genius.
I just like this idea. I think this is a really strong pointer, again, of that, how to avoid this dead convention idea. I'm thinking of it as a writer. I mean, this is a really good indicator for me as an artist or a writer.
And the solution to that is to become more facile in our work and facile in our ability to be shape-shifters. And then the end note is, a man's work ends at the setting sun. A shaman's work is never done. And the voyager is never complete. So we'll expand more on that in next week when we hit chapter 11 and we speak more specifically about shape-shifting up the totem.
Right.
That particular chapter may take us 2 weeks, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but we'll
really
see. So thank you for coming, and we'll look again to see you next week as we go through Life in the Labyrinth. Good night.
Good night, all.
Thanks, Dave and Ivan.
Thank you, George. Thank you, Susan.